What is going on, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of the Waterfowlers Heritage Podcast. I'm your host, Nathan Vaughn, and in today's episode, we got a little bit of a special one for you. So on the past two episodes we've done, we focused on some very specific events that have happened throughout the history of waterfowl hunting. And in today's episode, I'd actually like to kind of dive into a more broad view of several different time periods throughout our wonderful nation's history and how waterfowl hunting has affected that and how it has been incorporated into some very interesting stories and some very remarkable people that people may not think of off the top of their heads when they imagine waterfowl hunting. So stick with us, stay tuned, and we're going to get to it right now. All right, everybody. So like I said before, in today's episode, we're going to be looking at a couple of different stories from a couple of separate time periods about waterfowl and the connection that it has to some very interesting people and events that have happened throughout our history. So without further ado, we are going to jump right in. On a winter day in 1607, Captain John Smith, the controversial figurehead and sometime leader of Jamestown settlement, was hunting ducks along the marshy banks of Virginia's Chickahominy River when some 200 Pamunkey Indians ambushed his party, killed his companions, and took him captive. He was then presented to Powhatan, ruler of the region's federated tribes. Smith later wrote about this episode and the remarkable events leading up to his release in a series of journal entries, from which Powhatan and his daughter Pocahontas first entered into American folklore. It was not entirely by chance that duck hunting was part of one of America's earliest legends. The pursuit of waterfowl, along with other games such as deer, elk, bison, and turkey, was essential to the survival of the first American colonists and pioneers on the early frontier. Writings from settlers at Jamestown and Plymouth, as well as our journal entries written by Canada's pioneering fur traders and members of the Lewis and Clark Corps of Discovery, provide clear evidence of how important waterfowl hunting was to the hardy souls who colonized and explored the vast continent. To the modern sportsman, the storied abundance of fish and game is perhaps the most vivid aspect of the colonists' world. Their letters describe a land of plenty, turkey flocks exceeding 100 birds, oyster banks stretching more than a mile, and schools of cod that could fill countless boats. Thomas Morton, who had immigrated to Plymouth in 1624, was so amazed by the wealth of the land and sea that he labeled the new colony nature's masterpiece. Huge gatherings of ducks and geese, along with brants, were certainly part of the ecological wealth of an American colony during the 17th century. A few days after the Mayflower first dropped anchor in American waters, one pilgrim claimed he saw more waterfowl than he had ever seen in his life. Near Jamestown, Alexander Whitaker, a minister, reported that in winter, the rivers and creeks be overspread everywhere with waterfowl of the greatest and least sort. Swans, flocks of geese and brants, ducks, and other types of mallards, it is written, sheldrakes, which is another name for mergansers, divered, and etc. That was a quote given by Mr. Whitaker during the time. John Pory, who visited the Pilgrims Colony in January 1623, described the bay beyond Plymouth Harbor as, quote, covered with all sorts of waterfowl in such swarms and multitudes as is rather admirable than credible. The colonists were eager to harvest this bounty, and the success they enjoyed is recorded in their own words. In a book published in 1634, William Wood exclaimed, "If I should tell you how some have killed 100 geese a week, 50 ducks at a shot, 40 teals at another, it may be counted impossible, though nothing is more certain." And to kind of backtrack here for a second, when he refers to 50 ducks at a shot, what he's referring to is a specific hunting location that he was at. So a hunting spot is the exact same as a hunting shot. Thomas Morton then boasted, "I have had often 1,000 geese before the mouth of my gun." Down in Virginia, John Smith and two other Jamestown inhabitants also experienced some good luck when they bagged 148 waterfowl during one hunt. Events like that really make you kind of question what these guys were experiencing, and it also kind of shows you why in our modern world we have such strict and rigorous game laws, especially when it comes to waterfowl. I mean, I couldn't even envision or imagine bagging 148 waterfowl during one hunt with another individual. Back to the story. How the settlers went about hunting ducks was mostly determined by the capabilities of their firearms. During the first years of settlement, Jamestown's most common gun, the matchlock musket, was used for both hunting and military purposes. By 1630, both groups of settlers were hunting with fowling pieces, or fowlers, which were muskets designed specifically for shooting waterfowl. To increase stability and range, these guns had long, smoothbore barrels and stretched out 5 or even 6.5 feet in length. So to kind of analyze that a little bit, when you're looking at a gun that's 5 or 6 feet long, it's really kind of makes you look at and think about the classic punt gun that we understand was part of waterfowl hunting history, particularly during the market hunting era. These large punt guns that would sit at the bow of a boat that would be anchored to the boat itself and would shoot, I mean, hundreds of geese and ducks at a time using gauges as large as 2 gauges and even higher than that. But when he's referring to these waterfowling guns, he's talking about these kind of primitive fowl guns that were specifically designed muskets to harvest waterfowl, not quite as large as the punt guns we saw during the 1800s and early 1900s, but certainly a much larger gun than what we're used to shooting today. With their guns' limitations in mind, colonists planned their hunting strategies accordingly. A long, heavy barrel meant shooters needed a shooting stick or some other rest to be accurate. This also meant that all shots were taken when waterfowl were relatively stationary. Either standing in the marsh or dabbling in the water, many waterfowl were likely bagged by hunters who silently stalked rafts of duck or geese along the edges of lakes, rivers, and marshes. Similar to the way that we envision these market hunters during the late 1800s and early 1900s stalking these waterfowl throughout the coastal marshes, particularly along North Carolina, when they would come upon these rafts of diver ducks and even puddle ducks and shoot straight into the whole group and down as many birds as possible, as opposed to specifically hunting or looking for specific birds to hunt. Regardless, it's a very interesting thing to look at that this has been something that's been going on since our earliest colonial settlers were here and continued all the way up until the past 100 years when more strict regulations were put in place. Upon their arrival in America, securing adequate sources of food became a constant priority for the colonists and was frequently a cause for worry. In the first few years, the Pilgrims struggled to grow enough crops for their needs, and Jamestown took even longer to become self-sufficient on agriculture alone. Although both colonies often found themselves surrounded by nature's bounty, this abundance was seasonal. Periods of rich plentitude were often followed by times of bleak scarcity. And this bleak scarcity, along with the idea of these seasonal multitude of food, is an interesting thing to look at, because you got to think that these individuals that were growing and harvesting their own food would have had very beneficial times throughout the spring and summer months when planting and harvesting their crops throughout these warmer times. And then once it got cold, that would have been one of the bleakest periods of time, because, you know, large portions of game would have migrated into more difficult areas to hunt. But animals like waterfowl moving along the coast, especially in this mid-Atlantic area and Virginia and southern Massachusetts and down into the Carolinas, that would have been where these birds, these large numbers of birds, were wintering. So the Pilgrims and the individuals at Jamestown that were staying there would have been able to really supply themselves and live off of waterfowl throughout these bleak and tough times during the colder months of the year, as these waterfowl were coming into their wintering grounds in the mid-Atlantic region. Under these circumstances, it's easy to see why the colonists' attention would turn to hunting waterfowl in the fall, just as I said. As an illustration of the good times, Thomas Morton bragged that it had become a custom in his house to serve a whole duck to every person at his dinner table during this bleak time of winter when the waterfowl were migrating in. At Jamestown, John Smith recalled an episode when the fortunes of the colony were partially restored by the arrival of the first flight of migratory birds. In a letter to England, he stated that by October 1607, many colonists were afflicted by disease and fatigue, and the settlement was within 20 days of running out of provisions. Fortunately for the men of Jamestown, they were able to barter with neighboring Native Americans for corn and were soon greeted by the first ducks and geese of the season. It's quoted by John Smith as saying, "There came such abundance of fowls into the rivers as greatly refreshed our weak estates." So this is moving a little bit away. We just kind of analyzed and talked about colonial America and how waterfowl had such a big impact. Not only did a duck hunt result in the meeting of Pocahontas and the continuation of that legend to what we know today, including a Disney movie, but it also really saved the colonists at Jamestown and Plymouth, two of the earliest locations of European human habitation in the New World. Without waterfowl, it's likely that these individuals and these entire colonies would have fell apart and we would have lost all individuals within them, just like we did at Roanoke, simply because of lack of food during the winter months. So in a way, you can think ducks and geese and their migratory patterns into the mid-Atlantic as being part of the reason that we are sitting here today listening to this podcast in the United States. Right now, I'd like to kind of switch gears a little bit, same storyline, same general idea, but move away from colonial America and go into waterfowl and how it related to the fur trade, because this is another very interesting topic throughout our history that relates to waterfowl that a lot of people don't think about. While the early colonies along the Atlantic coast were becoming more established, waves of European explorers and pioneers ventured farther into the continent's interior. By the end of the 17th century, the Hudson Bay Company had established itself throughout much of eastern Canada as a large trading outfit, collecting beaver pelts and other furs, along with supplying a variety of Old World goods to trappers and native peoples. It was in the employment of the Hudson Bay Company that Henry Kelsey, the first European to travel to Canada's Great Plains region, kept a journal describing his life as a trader and explorer in the northern woodlands and prairie. Mr. Kelsey's words clearly reveal the importance of waterfowling to the livelihood of York Fort. Hudson Bay Company's primary trading post, located on the western shore of Hudson Bay in modern Manitoba, Canada. Journal entries from 1694 and 1696 show that inhabitants of the post and neighboring Cree Native Americans hunted geese during both the spring and fall staging periods. So to kind of unwind that little tidbit right there, when you're talking about the fall staging period, we're referring to an individual. Mr. Kelsey would have been in the prairies of Canada. So staging period is what we would now know as, you know, going up to Canada in the pothole regions and hunting during the very early season in, you know, September, late August, early October, when these geese and ducks are preparing to move south into the Americas, but are currently staging themselves up in the Canadian potholes. To hunt these large concentrations of geese, Kelsey and other traders would set up tents in the marshes surrounding the trading post, and along with Nelson and Hayes Rivers, these tents served as base camp and storehouses where harvested geese and ducks could be stockpiled before taking them to the fort. From the last week of April to the end of May in 1696, Kelsey recorded that 19 trips, more than 400 geese and ducks, were brought to the fort from the marshes. In return, supplies such as flour, shot, powder, and flints were shuttled from York Fort to Hudson Bay Company's men in the marshes or traded to the Cree hunters in exchange for geese. Over the years, this annual operation helped provide a crucial source of meat for the trading post, which could only receive supplies from England in the summer when Hudson Bay was free of ice and was actually manageable for individuals to travel it. The continued prosperity of the fur trade prompted HBC, Hudson Bay Company, and rivals such as Northwest Company to expand trade networks into Canada's western and northern boundaries. In 1789 and 1792, Alexander Mackenzie, an employee of Northwest Company stationed on Lake Athabasca in Alberta, led two expeditions intent on finding a nautical passage to the Pacific Ocean. His first excursion led him to the Arctic Ocean along a river that was later named in his honor. On his second attempt, he navigated to the Peace and Fraser Rivers, ultimately reaching the Pacific in summer of 1793. During both of these trips, Mr. Mackenzie made journal references to waterfowl he encountered on the way. Traveling near the Arctic Ocean, Mackenzie recorded lots of activity on the breeding grounds. He, quote, saw many wild fowl today with their young ones, but they were so shy that we could not approach them, end quote. However, in June of 1789, he noted, all the banks of the river are covered with wild fowl. We killed two swans, most likely tundra swans, 10 geese, one beaver this morning without losing an hour's time, so that if we were for the purpose of hunting, we might soon fill our canoe, end quote. While hunting geese and ducks was an important way of securing food in the wilderness, Mackenzie's crew of Canadian explorers had no time to linger at any of these good hunting spots or truly make exact notes of them, for their mission was to stay on the move and progress themselves across the Great Continent. So moving out of Canada's area, we're going to move down into a quite historic situation that took place in the United States, that being the Lewis and Clark Expedition. And while we all understand that Lewis and Clark did in fact encounter lots of wildlife and new species, one thing that we often don't think about is their relationship and how they interacted with waterfowl during their journey. it's popularized and a lot of times thought about that they encountered elk, bear, bison, the common Western icons of the American West. But an interesting thing to think about is the fact that individuals really hadn't encountered animals such as spoonbills or speckled belly geese or even snow geese in large volumes and numbers. Even animals like widgeon, other more Western waterfowl species that we see migrating throughout the Mississippi, the Central, and the Pacific Flyway. These are birds and these are waterfowl that individuals really wouldn't have seen in great numbers and especially not made note of in the Eastern Americas until the time of Lewis and Clark. So to continue on with that, building on the foundations laid by the early colonists and explorers, North America's population grew during the 17th and 18th centuries. In 1803, nearly 200 years after the founding of Jamestown and 30 years after the founding of the United States, President Thomas Jefferson commissioned Meriwether Lewis and William Clark's Corps of Discovery to explore the continent's vast western frontier. That same year, Jefferson had effectively doubled the size of the nation by purchasing the Louisiana Territory from France. This vast tract of new land represented another pristine area, largely untouched by white Americans or Europeans. Like Kelsey, Mackenzie, and the early colonists before them, the Corps' members left the comforts and familiarity of society and set off to face the challenges of an unexplored wilderness. As this group pushed west, game was their primary source of food, and hunting was key to their survival. Fortunately, Lewis and Clark encountered game of legendary proportions. On their trek, the expeditions traveled across the Mississippi, Central, and Pacific flyways and crossed paths with hosts of migrating waterfowl. While camping on the Columbia River, Captain Clark complained in his journal that he was kept awake during the night by multitudes of waterfowl. Dinners consisting of duck, goose, brant, crane, and swan also frequently appeared within his journals. Captain Lewis recorded at the end of July 1805 how a duck had provided an opportune meal. During a walk along the Missouri River, he managed to get somewhat ahead of the slow-moving main party and found himself alone at dusk. This quote right here is coming from the actual journals of Lewis and Clark, and it says, "By this time, it was getting nearly dark, and a duck lit on the shore within about 40 steps of me, and I killed it. I cooked my duck, which I found very good, and after eating it, laid down and should have had a comfortable night's lodge, but for the mosquitoes which infested me all night." End quote. You know, in many ways, this scene captures the essence of the explorer's lifestyle. Lewis had to take all that nature gave him, both duck dinners as well as mosquito bites and sleepless nights. This specific episode also reveals how much about waterfowl hunting interacted with the remainder of the expedition. Most of the time, members of the Corps shot game that was readily available or would yield the most meat, but when bison, elk, or other big game was absent, the explorers sought waterfowl, upland birds, rabbits, and other small game. Throughout the expedition, the Corps' hunters used flintlock rifles, but hunting waterfowl with a rifle was not an economical way to harvest birds due to meat damage. Although the party contained several top marksmen, powder and lead were so vital to their survival that conserving these commodities was a priority. As they passed west of what is now Bozeman, Montana on July 25, 1805, Lewis had to curb his men's enthusiasm for shooting geese. Again, coming from his journal, quote, "We killed a couple of young geese, which are very abundant and fine, but as they are but small game to subsist a party on of our strength, I have forbid the men to shoot at them, as it is a waste of considerably quantity of ammunition, as well as delays our progress," end quote. In a broader context, both captains viewed waterfowl as more than merely a source of food. While the Corps' primary objectives were commercial and political, Jefferson also charged its leaders to take note of any new plant and animal species that they should come across on their journey. In his journals, Lewis and Clark meticulously report the appearance of every new duck and goose, noting the coloration of its head, neck, wings, breast, and feet, the number of tail feathers, wings, bill length, and all other features relative to those of familiar eastern species. For example, he compared the snow goose to the Canadian goose and commented that he preferred the taste of the, quote, white brant to that of its eastern counterpart. The white-fronted goose, quote, tundra swan, and northern shoveler were also birds new to these men, and in 1806, near today's Rainier, Oregon, Lewis, quote, discovered the ringneck duck, which was previously unknown to science. So that's an interesting thing to think about here, is the fact that the ringneck duck was not known to science until the year 1806, when Lewis and Clark made their journey west and encountered it somewhere near Rainier, Oregon. The journals also recorded the migration patterns of waterfowl. On the shores of the Pacific Ocean, Lewis and Clark observed waterfowl flight patterns during their 3.5-month stay at Fort Clatsop. As the winter passed, they kept record as the birds migrated south and back north along the coast. On November 30, 1805, there was a, quote, great abundance of fowls, end quote. By January 31, 1806, the quote, swan, white brant, geese, and ducks still continue with us, end quote, while the brown or speckled brant are mostly gone, end quote. And on March 24th, the second day of their trip back up the Columbia, Lewis noted, quote, we saw very few waterfowl today, not a single swan, white brant, nor a small goose to be seen. So just so everybody understands what he's referring to, swan, he's referring to tundra swans, white brant, he's referring to snow geese, and small goose, he's referencing lessers or cackling geese. So just smaller Canadian goose, because in his mind, a goose would have been a Canada goose that he encountered on the eastern United States. Thus, a small goose would just simply be a lesser or a cackler. However, the Corps did continue to see and hunt waterfowl as they moved east toward the completion of their mission. Like the early colonists, the Corps of Discovery helped transform the wild America they knew into a modern landscape, partially tamed by agriculture and rapidly growing human populations. Alterations to the landscape, as well as advances in technology, changed the practice and significance of waterfowl hunting in this country. Yet regardless of how the sport has evolved through the years, waterfowling has remained a North American institution. After all, it has in fact been with us every step of the way. So everybody, thank you so much for being here today. I hope you were able to learn as much as I did going through this research and reading about how waterfowl hunting has related to very different aspects of our history as a nation and how we have interacted with waterfowl throughout its growth and its progress. I know this is kind of a lot of information, and it's very spread out across time periods, and all of these specific stories and information will be covered in later podcasts in more depth on these individual stories, such as we'll go through specific instances of waterfowl only on the Lewis and Clark expedition, and that'll be its own episode and things of that nature. But I kind of thought that it'd be interesting today, given that it's one of our earlier podcasts, to just dive right in headfirst and go over a full-length story of what these men, these founders of our country and the founders of our great sport of waterfowl hunting in America, encountered and lived through, going all the way back to the first colonists at Plymouth and Jamestown, and all the way through the discovery of animals like ringneck ducks, tundra swans, snow geese, specks, shovelers even. But I hope you guys enjoyed this as much as I have. Thank you all for being here today, and I look forward to making the next episode. And y'all have a great rest of your week, and I hope everyone is having a wonderful Christmas season so far, and we'll get back to you shortly with the next episode. Thank you all so much. Hey everybody, one quick note in closing as we end this episode right here. Just wanted to let all you guys know that this is a pleasure for me to make. I really enjoy going through this information and talking to you guys about it. And if you really like the podcast, please tell a friend, share it on social media, and be sure to subscribe on Apple, Google Play, Spotify, wherever you're listening to this podcast right now. Thank you all again. Have a wonderful rest of your day or night, and we will see you on the next one.